From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Lansing's mayor pushes back as the president cracks down on undocumented immigrants.
This is not a fascist state, and it's not going to become that way on my watch.
A surprising slump in March auto sales.
We are seeing inventories climb, and I do think what we will see going forward is more production cuts.
A Michigan professor and his book of Japanese poetry takes Japan by storm.
Writing in Japanese is strangely liberating in some ways because I don't feel like I necessarily have to be beholden to my own kind of preconceived notions of how the language should sound.
And we meet a port here on Virtuoso with a very unique musical instrument.
I'm a whistler. That's all I am, is a whistler.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lansing City Council last night made its city a sanctuary city. Six members voted yes, nobody voted no. And before the council meeting, Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero issued an executive order spelling out just how police officers will treat undocumented immigrants without using the words sanctuary city. So let's see where things stand in Lansing as we welcome Mayor Virge Bonero. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Mayor.
My pleasure.
So the council passes its resolution last night declaring Lansing to be a sanctuary city, but your order supersedes that resolution and it doesn't mention the word sanctuary city. Why is that?
Well, I wouldn't say my order supersedes the resolution. My order relates to the operations of the police department. And under our charter, the mayor is the CEO of the city, and the mayor runs the police department and all other departments. So the council does not have authority to give specific orders as it relates to how the police conduct themselves. In a sense, they're separate but related documents. In my view, the council's action is a symbolic vote, which I'm not saying it is without value. It's a symbolic vote that means a lot to a lot of people. I don't know what it means from a legal standpoint. My executive order speaks to the operations. It essentially standardizes and memorializes how the police will conduct themselves vis-a-vis undocumented people in their day-to-day lives. It doesn't really create new law. There was a gray area. We had, in other words, most of our policies with the Lansing Police Department were verbal. They were unwritten rules. And, you know, we did not enforce. We are not enforcers of immigration law. We are not federal agents, and we don't intend to be. And so we've been operating a certain way. We enforce the law without regard to immigration status and without regard to, you know, other statuses.
So it's been a gray area. Why do you feel it's important now to kind of codify what police will and won't do in Lansing?
Because the Trump administration has created such fear in the community, in the minority community, and in the community among immigrants and the refugee population, that we felt we have to make it clear where we stand and what we're doing. And this way, you know, it's out there. So the city attorney, I worked with the city attorney and the police chief on what we have been doing and what the federal law is and what the state law is. We think that what we're doing does comport with federal law. But now it's out there. It's in black and white. It's very clear. This is how we operate in Lansing, that we're going to enforce the law. We're going to, and we're going to do that without regard to your particular status. We're not singling anybody out. We're not profiling people, but we will enforce the law. We will certainly, just like in an emergency room, you know, there's triage. You treat the worst first. When we answer 911 calls, we answer the most serious things first, and so we go after serious criminals. We're not targeting people, any person, for low-level offenses, and we're not the immigration police.
And you said that last night at the meeting, right? You're saying that you do not want Lansing police to become de facto immigration agents.
We do not want it, and we will fight it. In fact, and we're looking at all legal options. We're looking at actions that other cities have filed. We're considering becoming amicus in some other actions. We're looking at all of our legal options to preserve our local authority. We believe that local police should be enforcing, you know, local and state law, and that the federal government has a role, and we've always had, you know, important partnerships, good partnerships with federal authorities, but we're not at their command, and we're not part of a federalized police force. So I think that local control and those local issues are very important, and we intend to fight for that. We intend to stand up and fight for that so that, you know, we can continue to build that bridge. We believe community policing works. We believe the best security is when our people trust us. So police credibility is very important. We want to preserve that and continue that. And we think, you know, in essence, federalizing local police departments is very dangerous, and it would be bad for our officers and bad for the community. And so we intend to fight that.
Mayor Bonnero, here you've got your executive order kind of codifying what police will and won't be doing. You have the council voting unanimously to declare the city to be a sanctuary city. And at the same time, you have the Trump administration making it very clear that if they feel cities have designated themselves sanctuary cities, their federal funding is threatened. And I know, Lansing, what, about $6.5 million a year from the federal funding?
Yes. Well, thankfully, Cynthia, we are a government of laws and not of men. Because I have deep reservations and concerns and disagreements with the men who are Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions. I'm appalled by their actions and by their statements. But we're a government of laws, and so we're allowed to have opinions about men, and we're allowed to even disagree about the law. And when we disagree about the law, we'll take it to court. And so while we believe our actions comport with federal and state law, we're willing to fight, as I said. We're willing to go to court to stand up for human dignity and for human rights and for individual rights.
But it certainly seems cities like Lansing are having to walk a very thin tightrope in wanting to say to their immigrants who live there, look, we are not going to have our police targeting you or seeking you out. And at the same time, you don't want to lose that federal funding and run afoul of the White House.
Well, but we're willing to risk running afoul of the White House. That's a fact, because I believe that it's a very dangerous precedent. I believe that what the Trump administration has embarked upon is very dangerous for this democracy, for this republic, and I'm willing to stand up for these principles. I do not want to live in a country as mayor or as citizen where we have a federalized local police force. We don't have that here. We have local police departments, and we have local control of those departments, and we're going to fight for those principles. I want to safe community, but that's determined here. And we set our priorities for enforcement. We are not ICE agents. We are not immigration officers, and we do not intend to be. We are not going to allow, through sleight of hand and through individual threats and so on, that these men believe that they're going to impose their will and their unique view of the world on us. This is not a fascist state, and it's not going to become that way on my watch.
Lansing Mayor Virge Bonnero, thank you so much for speaking with us, Mr. Mayor.
My pleasure. Thanks.
U.S. automakers sold 1.56 million new cars and trucks in March. Now, that is down 1.6% from March 2016 levels. Auto Trader senior analyst Michelle Krebs is here with us now. Michelle, what is this 1.6% decline about?
Well, I think it got a lot of headlines because it surprised us. We were forecasting, for example, sales would be up 3%, and it ended up being down almost 2%. I think what is happening is we have seen an unprecedented 7 consecutive years of year-over-year sales gains, and we're tapering off. We're plateauing at a peak, whatever you want to say, and this is a cyclical industry. I think we need not get alarmed. We're still at a very high level of sales.
And what is selling and what is not selling?
Well, what is not selling, and that's why I think sales were particularly low this last month, are traditional cars, so small cars and especially mid-size sedans, things like the Ford Fusion and the Chevrolet Malibu. And what is selling instead are sport utility vehicles, especially the compact ones, the mid-size ones. And I think it's just a matter of, I think there are demographic issues that are driving that, and I think there are people see them as more practical and versatile.
Now, when you say demographic issues, like what?
Well, for instance, we have the biggest population of car buyers coming on board with the millennials, and they are finally getting into the car market, and some of them are getting older. They're having children, and when you have children, you have car seats that many of us baby boomers didn't have to deal with as much, and they're much easier to deal with in sport utility vehicles, you know, fancy strollers. So we're seeing that is a demographic that's really driving that shift.
And I'm just thinking in our own home, if we want to talk baby boomers, my husband's lease was up on his car, and he turned it in and came home with the same brand, but a compact SUV, and he loves it.
And that's the other demographic. The aging baby boomers find it easier to just slide into those sport utility vehicles versus dropping down and sitting in a car.
Hmm.
And there is this, I think a lot of people like that higher position on the road feel.
Now, what about company? Who's up, who's down?
Well, it varies. I mean, there were some that were up, but not as much as we thought. For example, General Motors was up, but it wasn't as much as we thought. Ford was down exactly where we thought it would be. Ford's been struggling on the car side. The Ford Fusion, Ford Focus had really bad months, but the Ford F-150 had a stellar month. Honda was didn't perform as we thought it would. So a lot of us missed on the forecast. So I would say that's more what was shocking to us.
And so what does this mean, I guess, starting for automakers in terms of, is it time to rethink the way they're using incentives?
Well, we are seeing incentives at a record level. We are seeing them use them smarter. They aren't just blanketing the market with incentives. We are actually seeing them using big data to focus in almost right down to the person and to the specific vehicle, and they're using them in geographic regions. I do think we are seeing inventories climb, and I do think what we will see going forward is more production cuts. We've seen some, but I think we'll see more. I would expect you might see some extended summer vacations, for example.
And what about for consumers? Do the softening sales mean that buyers can get out there and dig up some better deals?
It is a great time for consumers, although I will say it's a little more complicated. So there are some great deals on new vehicles, especially if you want a midsize sedan, you can pretty much call the shots. But there's also a lot of vehicles coming in off lease. We call them nearly new cars. So those offer some really good deals, too, if you don't want to stretch to a new car. Yeah, there's a lot of great choice and a lot of great offers, but you have to do a lot of homework, too.
And Michelle, as you say, you know, it's a cyclical industry. We know nothing lasts forever. But and you say it's too early to get worried. But where might these softening sales take the auto industry if you look out ahead?
We don't see a big downturn any on our horizon. We don't look out more than a couple of years. So we think that they can continue along at this kind of 17 million level, high 16s, for the next couple of years. Beyond that, it's anybody's guess.
Auto Trader Senior Analyst Michelle Krebs. Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I'm a whistler. That's all I am, is a whistler. I get no respect. Ask Rodney Dangerfield. He'd tell you all about it.
We will meet the self-proclaimed world's greatest whistler. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He calls himself the world's greatest whistler, and it's pretty hard to argue against that claim.
A medley entitled Flight of the Flying Lip Lock, Ralph Geza.
How's everybody doing tonight?
That's Ralph Geza of Port Huron, who started whistling when he was 3, and more than 5 decades later, he is still going strong. Ralph Geza, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, this is whistling on a whole different level, and you don't purse your lips. This is what, throat whistling?
No, it's not throat whistling. It's open mouth whistling.
Okay.
And the funnel of air goes through the tongue and the roof of the mouth.
Now, I've never seen this before. I'm so used to people pursing their lips, the standard whistle. How did you learn this?
I cheated. I couldn't pucker whistle. When I was 3 years old, in order to be cool with my friends, I had to know how to whistle. And I had a heck of a time just trying to pucker whistle.
Yeah.
I can go in,
okay.
But I'd go out a little. I'd go...
Yeah, pretty much what my sad whistling...
Pretty much, tip of my tongue. And I used to do that. And after a while, I just started concentrating more on making the funnel of air go through the whole middle of my mouth. If you look up into my mouth, the tongue's curled. It looks like a V.
So you're one of those who can genetically curl their tongue. So you've got your tongue rolled. You can roll your tongue.
Well, you know, kind of, I guess. On the roof of my mouth, it's kind of like it serves as a reed, like a reed on a clarinet.
It sure does.
Back in the days before electricity, you know, the clarinet was a real popular instrument.
It was indeed.
They could really shred with that thing.
Reed of a bagpipe, reed of a saxophone.
Yeah. And, you know, the shredding is the cool thing, you know.
So did you kind of invent this then? No one taught you how to do it? You just kind of improvised and tried to be a better whistler?
The whistle, yeah, whistling, yes. I just taught myself, and I never heard anybody do it, never saw anybody do it until I was about 17 years old. I went to Chuck Barris told me to go to Carson City, Nevada, to the World's Whistle Off, and I went out there. And there was a guy that whistled similar like me with an open mouth, and he was a lawyer from Hawaii, and he had a full band with him playing behind him, and I thought he was rocking pretty good, but then when he saw me, I never came back.
Oh.
I never did see him again. That guy's name was Nelson Christensen. There was another guy, Fernando Hernandez. He was from Mexico City. And he whistled open mouth style. He did hat dances and stuff like this. And
I've got to wonder, is there some society of open mouth whistlers?
No.
So there's not many of you?
No, usually then they see me and then they end up retiring or something. I don't know.
Now, has your sound evolved and changed through the years as perhaps you've gotten older? Is it a different sound than what you were doing 20, 30 years ago?
I don't really think so. I think the sound is all the same. I think I'm a better whistler today than I was 50 years ago.
Practice makes perfect.
I mean, I've been whistling for since I was 3 years old. I've whistled for 54 years, you know, so that's a lot of whistling. And
you kind of incorporate now singing with the whistling.
Well, I wanted to be a rock and roll star with my whistling, man. I knew for sure the Rolling Stones were going to have me whistle on one of their records, you know, but one record would come out after another and I'd hear this stuff and nobody ever said, hey, whistler, why don't you come and do something? So, you know, nobody has anything for whistlers.
They don't write for whistlers.
So what I did is I had to make a decision that if either I'm going to give this up or I'm going to have to do something else to fill in the time. So I made up words to songs. And, Brian and I were working on a record, you know.
And Brian is your guitarist, Brian Sprung, who's with us today.
Yes, he's my
And I love the name of your band, Whistlers Mothers, and that's M-U-T-H-E-R-S. And by the way, we should tell everybody you have a Facebook page. People can search for Whistlers Mother. Let's take a listen to some more of your whistling. And this is Ralph Giza of Port Huron, accompanied by his guitarist, Brian Sprung.
Hey, Whistler, you like some peanut butter?
I love me some peanut butter. I like all kinds of peanut butter. Jiffy, Skippy, Peter Pan. Come on, Brian. You know, I ain't prejudiced about my peanut butter. It come from the East Coast, the West Coast,
the North, the South.
I don't care.
Just as long as it's rich and creamy.
But you know what I found? I found they got the creamiest peanut butter deep down south.
Like in Georgia.
Ain't it something? Georgia got peaches too.
But that's a whole nother song. This one here about peanut butter.
Talent of yours, Ralph, has taken you to some pretty interesting places. I saw a YouTube clip of you with the one and only Johnny Carson. That had to have been pretty cool.
Well, that was very cool, yes. That was very cool. Back then, you had to go for 3 days if you went on TV. One day to travel, and then you get there, and they come to your room, and they have a little pre-interview with you. And then the next day, they whisk you to the studios and
in beautiful downtown Burbank, as Johnny used to say.
Whatever. I don't know what's so beautiful about
that
it.
Well, that's what he was being sarcastic.
Okay. Okay.
He used to say, Here we are in beautiful downtown Burbank.
Yeah.
And you've done America's Got Talent.
Yeah, we did that. Yes.
How'd that
Brian's
fare?
Over there laughing.
How did that fare?
That's when I finally, decided that I could call myself the world's greatest whistler. I goofed that right up. I can goof up every opportunity that I can get, and I'll just goof it up.
Do you have favorite genres?
I grew up listening to a lot of Rolling Stones. More than anything, I was Rolling Stones. Now, it was the Zeppelin. You know, I used to like to whistle the way that Jimmy Page just shreds that guitar. It was just amazed me, you know.
Can you give me a little Stairway to Heaven?
That cost you some money. Mm-hmm. That cost you extra because the Stairway to Heaven.
A little bit of that guitar solo.
That's about all you're going to
do. I'm fascinated because you're playing with your hands, too. Now, do you play as well?
I play an air guitar sometimes when I'm on stage.
Yep. Okay.
It helps the accompany of the whistle. It helps the notes go right where they need to go. Because most of the time was, whistling with a pool cue in my hand and playing that air guitar.
What does it feel like when you're in the middle of a song, you are in your whistling zone? What does it feel like? Is it a hard thing to do or does it just, flows?
No, it flows. Yeah, Brian came early, yesterday he came in and we were working on another song, a reggae genre song, because the Rolling Stones, they used to have a rock and roll song, they'd have a punk rock song, they'd have a blues song, they'd have a reggae song. They had all these different genres on these records, and that's the way we're designing this one.
Now, have you made records?
Well, no, we're just starting.
That's something you want to do. And you do get sometimes other musicians together and just kind of do a gig?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I still have my favorite shredders out there. We got a pretty good one here in Detroit. I like to go listen to that Eric Goble. He's a good old buddy that can really do some shredding.
You know what? I am only the world's biggest Who fan. Do you do any Who?
You put me on the spot.
I know, man. I am. We do that in radio. You get the rhythms, you get the notes.
It's been a long time since
it's okay. Don't apologize. It's really good stuff. So, were you always naturally musician? Were you musical? Besides the, class as a kid? Or
yeah, I did. Yeah, mm-hmm. I sang a lot and I did a lot of singing. I was kind of a class clown. And the really cool thing? I used to sit in school. I'd bite my fingernails like this, and I'd whistle. I do those real odd notes, and the closer that the teacher came, the quieter I would do it. And the farther they would go, the louder I would do it. They never knew who was doing it.
Which one of these kids?
Sixth grade teachers would not tell any of the seventh graders teachers because it took them so long to finally. And a lot of the teachers, it wasn't until the last day of school where I would confess, I'm the one. Listen to this.
I'm the culprit, and here you go.
Yeah, that was a cool thing, and it was fun.
Have you been able to take this beyond, like a very cool party or club trick? Are you able to, kind of get out there and build a career doing this, or is this kind of, you got to have another day job?
Well, no, that's all I do is this. Either you're in or out.
Do you get respect from other musicians?
No. I'm a whistler. That's all I am is a whistler. I'm not a musician.
You play your mouth.
I get no respect. Ask Rodney Dangerfield. He'd tell you all about it.
A lot of fun.
Of the same thing.
Well, I know people can. You're all over YouTube. You can search for Ralph Giese, and that's G-I-E-S-E. So you can find him on YouTube or search on Facebook for Whistlers Mothers, M-U-T-H-E-R-S. Thank you so much. A lot of fun to have you both with us. And we're going to ask you, Ralph Giese of Port Huron, the self-proclaimed world's greatest whistler, along with your guitarist, Brian Sprung. Please take us out on another number. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's a unique way of bridging the generation gap. Three Western Michigan University students are more than 6 months into a 19-month stint living side by side with senior citizens at the Clark Retirement Community on Keller Lake near Grand Rapids. It's one of the first research projects of its type in the country, exploring attitudes and stereotypes about students and seniors and giving the three students deep insights into aging. We first spoke with Charlie Lundstrom and WMU grad student Colette Chapp last September, just after Colette and two other students had moved into Clark at Keller Lake. So, Charlie, Colette, it's good to have you both back.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Charlie, we've got about 6 months now of living together in the same community. How's life? What's been kind of different now that you've got these younger people?
Well, I don't see enough of them. That's the problem. Of course, they are working in addition to going to school, and I just don't see. You know, yesterday, Colette came in and showed me a wonderful set of photographs she had taken in her trip to Ireland and talked about what they did in Ireland, and that was very nice. And Lori, the older gal, has been teaching me how to use a computer.
Yes, in fact, I remember, Charlie, you told us you were hoping that being around these students would sharpen your computer skills. So you're getting better?
Well, I'm now learning, yes.
And Colette, I remember when we talked last fall, you said you hoped your poker game was going to improve from playing with folks who've been doing it for decades. So how is your poker game these days?
I wouldn't say I win very much, but I definitely understand what's going on now.
How have you found living amongst the seniors at the Clark Retirement Community different from like past living experiences when you were living with people who were your own age?
It's definitely a different atmosphere. When I was living in the dorms in undergrad, there was that connectedness that we were all going through pretty much the same thing, and we were all at pretty much the same stage of life. But living at Clark, we're at such opposite ends of life, which is actually, I think, refreshing because I get a different perspective on life because I'm with people that have gone through so much more than I have.
So what kinds of insights maybe have you gleaned from being able to talk to these folks?
Well, it definitely helps me keep things in perspective because it's very easy for me to get wrapped up in school and the stresses of just everyday life at this age. But interacting with the residents helps me keep my priorities straight because it helps me remember that one day I'm not going to be in school anymore and I won't be working anymore. And what will I want left in my life at that point?
And Charlie, flip side of that, what do you think you've gleaned from being with the students and how has it changed your views about young people?
Well, it's improved our view. They're very intelligent and very easy to talk to. I think they have acclimated themselves very nicely into the group. I would like to talk to them more. I like to get more at meals, but because of their work schedule and their school schedule, I don't get an opportunity at meals to talk with them very much. You have to understand that this is an assisted living place, but it's also an old folks' home. I mean, I'm 87, and I'm a youngster here. Most of the people here are, frankly, in their 90s. And as you get into that age, you have different needs and different desires. But it's always nice to talk with younger people. I've been very happy with the way it's worked out.
Colette, how do you think this whole experience, has it changed your feelings about your eventual old age?
I went into it with a pretty positive viewpoint on aging because I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and my grandparents are a really great example of positive aging and staying involved with the community. But it has changed my perspective of what needs to be worked on in our culture of aging and what we can improve in other people's stereotypes of aging and just like how we can provide better care based on the needs of this population.
Yeah, what would you like to see change based on what you're learning from this experience?
I think we as a society have a tendency to overlook the senior population just because it's uncomfortable to realize that people that you admired that were your role models when you were younger have started declining and have more needs. And I think that's just uncomfortable. And so we don't like to acknowledge it or deal with it. So I would like to bring it to the forefront and kind of remove the stigma of aging and prove that these residents that I live with and older adult population have so much to give to society and they have so much more that they can offer us.
What do you think you'll be bringing to your future career as an occupational therapist?
I think on a very superficial level, I will be bringing a greater skill of actively listening to people because living with these residents, I've had to learn that sometimes they'll present me with problems that I can't fix and I just need to be there to listen, and that's really all that they want from me at that moment. And also, I feel like I have such a greater understanding of the needs of this community and how many times that's overlooked, especially by young adults that are working with them, because they've never experienced what older adults are experiencing. But by living in their community, I feel like I'm getting a better idea of that, and I can bring those insights into my work in the future.
Charlie Lundstrom and Colette Chapp talking about life at Clark on Keller Lake in West Michigan. Ever since Colette and two other occupational therapy students from Western Michigan University moved to the senior residence, and they will be living in that retirement community until April 2018. Plenty of time for computer skills to get better and poker skills to get better, both of you. Thank you so much. We look forward to checking back in with you soon.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Still to come, what is the future of the robotics industry in Michigan?
There's a lot of things that robots are doing today that they couldn't have done years ago.
Plus, a Michigan professor makes history as he wins Japan's biggest poetry prize. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. An American winning the equivalent of Japan's Pulitzer Prize for poetry he wrote in Japanese. That's exactly what Jeffrey Engels has accomplished, as he was honored recently with the prestigious Yomiuri Prize for Literature in Poetry. It's the first time an American has won this Japanese poetry prize. Jeffrey Engels is a professor of world languages and literatures at Western Michigan University. Winning this prize caps a lifetime of interest in the Japanese language, interest that dates back to his very first trip to Japan when he was just 15. Jeffrey Engels, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I'm really happy to be speaking to you today.
Tell us about the book of poetry that won this very prestigious prize.
Well, first of all, I should say that this was an incredible surprise when this happened. This is my first book of poetry. I started writing poetry in Japanese around the year 2010. As a professor, I studied Japanese literature, and I'd always been interested in Japanese poetry. I'm a passionate reader of poetry in English as well. So at a certain point, after studying Japanese poetry for a long time, after translating a lot of Japanese poetry, I decided to see if I could write it myself. And to my surprise, it worked out.
They clearly liked it. And I know the title of the book translates to My International Dateline, and I will let you tell me what that is in Japanese.
Oh, in Japanese, it's Watashi no Hizuke Henkousen.
And what are the themes that you explore in this book, Jeffrey?
So I started writing the book when I was living in Japan in 2009, 2010, 2011. You know, I'd spent a lifetime going back and forth between the Midwest and Japan, especially going back and forth, yearly, a couple of times a year after becoming a professor here at Western Michigan University. So so I wrote a lot about the experience of that sense of dislocation that happens when you're kind of have one foot in one culture here and one foot in one culture there. That's a major theme of a couple of the poems.
And I'm going to say, as I read the English translations of your poems, anyone who has that feeling, for me it is Ireland. I married a man from Ireland. We have a cottage in Ireland. We have all of our family is in Ireland. Uh-huh. And I know what you mean about having one foot on either side of an ocean.
Yeah.
And so it's very relatable no matter what that other land is that you have kind of has taken a piece of your heart.
Oh, good, good, good. I'm really glad to hear that. There is a funny sensation that sort of happens when you do feel connected to two places. When I'm in Japan, I don't feel like I have the newest information about what's happening in America with my friends and so on. And when I'm in Japan, you know, exactly the same thing. It almost doesn't matter if we have Facebook and Twitter and that sort of thing. There's still a certain way that being in a place affects you much more than, you know, just connecting to them through the net.
Well, to that point, I'm going to ask if you'd be kind enough to read us the poem titled Time Difference, and we'd love to hear you do it in Japanese and in English.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Jisa, watashi no asa wa anata no yoru. Anata no akebono wa watashi no tasogare. Heiko shiteru ga setten wa nai. Onaji chikyu ni sunde itte mo onaji taiyo o miru koto wa nai. Time difference. My morning is your night. Your dawn is my twilight. We move in parallel, yet we never intersect. We inhabit the same earth, yet never see the same sun. Voices alone cross the barrier of time. We turn into electromagnetic waves, losing all touch, scent, and taste. As we rush along thin filaments, my questions return to the past. Your answers fly into the future.
Time only proceeds for me. My tomorrow is your yesterday. No, the day before last. No, an entire week ago. Stop the clock, but time doesn't halt. The year ends and a new one begins. Your voice grows weaker until finally it is gone. Left alone, I yearn for you, who remain eternally young as I push forward in the direction where death lies hiding in wait. Zenponi tsuki susumu shikanai. Machi fusete iru shi e mukatte.
That is Jeffrey Engels, who's a professor at Western Michigan University, whose book of Japanese poetry has just won the prestigious Yomiuri Prize in Japan for Literature and Poetry. He's the first American to win that poetry prize. And I'm wondering, what kind of response have you gotten from people in Japan with your book and with the fact that here you are, a professor from Michigan winning this prestigious Japanese award?
People were surprised, I think. There was a lot of interest in my book because of, it wasn't just the ordinary Japanese poets that they were expecting. My book apparently sold out its first printing quite quickly. And a friend of mine who was recently in Japan told me that he went all over the place and to bookstore after bookstore, and they told him, oh, no, sorry, we just sold our last copy. So it's a wonderful thing to happen.
What is it about writing in Japanese that you really most enjoy?
Writing in Japanese is strangely liberating in some ways because I don't feel like I necessarily have to be beholden to my own kind of preconceived notions of how the language should sound. So I've been able to experiment a little bit in Japanese, and that's been great fun.
Jeffrey, what was it about that first trip to Japan, you were only 15, that so grabbed your heart and mind to the point where this really is your life's work?
Oh, goodness. So when I was 15, I grew up in Ohio. I really hadn't been too much outside of the Midwest. I'd only been to the Atlantic Ocean once. I had seen mountains only a few times in my life. So when I was 15, I went to a small fishing town in western Japan, a place called Shimonoseki, a place where the mountains just rise directly out of the sea. And so here I was in this really unfamiliar and exciting landscape, surrounded by things that were in some ways very familiar, but were all just different enough that I felt like I was seeing everything for the first time. So I decided, oh my gosh, I have to learn this language. I have to do this. I have to master it. So I started learning Japanese and worked really hard. And here I am all these 30 years later.
Finally, what adjectives would you use to try to explain what the Japanese culture is like to us sitting here in Michigan listening to you?
Oh, goodness. That's surprisingly hard to sum up in just a few words. But one of the things that I'd like to stress to listeners is that all cultures are made up of people, and people are all individuals. We all feel the same kinds of concerns, the same kinds of anxieties. So once we begin to kind of sit down and talk to people at the individual level, questions of culture begin to kind of fall away as we begin to see people as individuals. So, that being the case, when I interacted with people, and one of the big discoveries that I had when I was 15 years old in Japan was that people were just like me. And yes, there were differences in cultures and the way that people express themselves. People tend to be a little bit more reserved. They tend to be a little bit shyer about sharing personal information and so on. But once we, kind of crossed those surface level boundaries, people were the same.
Jeffrey Engels is a professor of Japanese literature and translation at Western Michigan University and the 2017 winner of the Yomiuri Prize for Literature and Poetry, the first American to win that Japanese poetry prize for the book. The title is My International Dateline, and Jeffrey, once again in Japanese, that is?
Watashi no Hizuke Henkousen.
Congratulations, and thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The march of the robots continues. Artificial intelligence and automation play an ever-increasing role in the workplace, particularly in manufacturing. Just what is the future of the robotics industry in our state of Michigan, and what might it mean for workers? Jeff Bernstein is with us. He's the president of the Ann Arbor-based Association for Advancing Automation. Pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is the mission of the association?
Our goal is to promote the use of robotics and related technologies in order to create better, safer, and higher-paying jobs for Americans.
Who do you represent? Who are your stakeholders?
We represent over 1,000 companies throughout the world involved in automation. So they're suppliers of the technology, but also major users and consultants and system integrators, educators, the whole ecosystem.
So you can really see effects and how it's working its way into the workplace and what it's doing with workers.
Absolutely. And we're also able to get input from the people who are using the technology, which is a great strength of our trade association.
What are we seeing in terms of robotics growth? And I'm just wondering, can we even focus it on Michigan? Are you able to give us a sense of how much it's grown?
Not specifically on Michigan, although you can infer. The industry is growing at double digits each year and is expected to for the next several years. Record sales each year. The biggest user is the automotive industry. So GM, Ford, Chrysler, all investing heavily in robotics, and likely that makes this area in Michigan one of the leading places to find robotics.
The auto industry was really kind of the groundbreakers for so much of use of robotics.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then what other industries are we seeing it get inroads?
Oh, consumer goods, warehousing and distribution, electronics, food. Almost every industry is looking at robotics right now.
And what kind of tasks can robots do?
Well, usually the dull, dangerous, and dirty jobs, like welding and painting in an automotive factory. But we're increasingly seeing robots doing work side by side with humans in warehouses, packaging food. There's a lot of things that robots are doing today that they couldn't have done years ago.
Jeff, there's this common perception that I'm sure you encounter all the time that an increase in robotics equals lost jobs. How accurate is that?
Well, I can tell you, we encounter this every day. We took a 20-year look at this from 1996 to 2015. And the results were counterintuitive, let's say. In every period where robot sales were rising, unemployment was falling. And in every period where robot sales were falling, unemployment was rising. Now, why is that? We believe it's because the real threat to jobs is the inability to compete. And when companies invest in robotics, they give their company a better chance to compete and therefore save and create new jobs. And we have all kinds of anecdotal stories about this.
Give us a Michigan story.
A Michigan story, a company called Vickers Engineering on the west side of the state. They were having a difficulty keeping people in these entry-level, dull, dangerous, and dirty jobs. So they would hire them, they would train them, and then the people would leave, and then they would retrain new people. And it was a real drag on their ability to compete. So they decided, let's invest in automation. They did. And as a result, they were able to bring their costs down. They eliminated this turnover that was going on and were able to successfully win new business that they couldn't have won before. In their case, I think it was from Toyota. As a result, since they've automated, they've won new business and added more people than they had before they started. This is not unusual.
The people that were doing those dull, dangerous, dirty jobs, do they have the skills to move up to better jobs?
They could, because a lot of the jobs require skills that you can get at community colleges and technical schools. These are not all four-year degree engineering jobs. These are machine operators, people who have hands-on ability to install the technology. These are a lot of where the growth is going to be in the jobs.
And the kind of jobs that are more interesting and will keep people there longer.
Yeah, we think. I mean, today's manufacturing facilities are nothing like people remember from years past. They're not dirty places. They're very clean. They're high tech. They're great environments to work in, and there are tremendous jobs there.
When you look at the research on jobs and automation, there are such widely divergent findings. One that I dug up in 2013, a couple of researchers from Oxford found that robotics would be putting 48% of the jobs in the United States in danger. And then last year, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development figured, well, across 21 countries, 9% of jobs would be automated. Why is there such a major difference?
Well, in the case of that Oxford study, I actually debated them. They're looking at tasks and they're saying, here's what the technology can do that people are doing. Therefore, that equals the jobs are going to disappear. That's not at all the case. And some of the other studies have looked at, well, jobs are going to disappear at a slower pace. But the reality is, ask some of these companies how many jobs they would have if they hadn't automated. And the answer is often zero. The reason, because they would have had to send these jobs overseas to China or Mexico or somewhere else, but automation allowed them to compete. So we believe we can't easily describe the jobs of the future, We're not real good at that as a country. 20 years ago, would you have known, Cindy, that there would be a job called social media director or search engine optimization specialist? No, of course not. But they exist today, and there are a lot of people doing them. We think the same thing is going to happen in robotics and automation.
When we hear talk about manufacturing jobs being lost to trade, which is a very common theme of President Trump's, an equally common response is, wait, wait, more jobs have been lost to automation and those jobs are not coming back. Where do you see that narrative?
We think those jobs in some places are already coming back and more will continue. More importantly, we think a lot of jobs won't have to go overseas in the first place. But what's going to happen here is if we are able to generate more manufacturing jobs, automation is going to be a part of this. Again, the key to all of this is the inability to compete is the threat to jobs. If you're working for a company that can't compete, your job's at risk. If you're working for a company that's automated, they may be able to win new business and create even more jobs.
We have seen increasing use, as you describe, of robotics in manufacturing, but I've also realize there's more and more progress in artificial intelligence software that can think and read and analyze what we say and write. Do you think we could see AI replacing the kind of jobs that kind of seem to be beyond the reach of technology, the thinking, reading, writing jobs?
Well, I think they're already doing some things in those areas, particularly in writing. They're helping write news stories. They're helping do legal research. They're helping do medical research. Replace isn't the goal. I think it's to augment people and the technology working together. So you think about it. Can a doctor read all of the medical research that's out there? First of all, they don't have time. And second of all, even if they did have time, there's so much. They're trying to make a diagnosis for their patient. If automation can help them do that by doing all that work for them, providing them with information to make an intelligent diagnosis, I think that's a great thing.
Looking out, let's say, over the next 20, 30 years, how do you see robotics affecting Michigan's economy?
Well, we expect it to have a very positive impact on Michigan's economy. I mean, again, I look back. I grew up in the Detroit area. So I look at what happened in Detroit with all these shuttered factories. And I think to myself, what if some of those could have stayed open had they have automated instead of having to send jobs to China or elsewhere? We'd have a chance. We would have had better, safer neighborhoods. We would have had better tax base. We would have had better schools. Because it's not only the jobs in the factory that are at risk. What happens is when those factories close, there are a number of jobs that depend on those factories. So not only the suppliers of technology into the factories, but the bowling alleys and restaurants and bars and employing all sorts of people that depended on a factory being there. So I think this is good news for Michigan if we can invest more in automation.
What drew you to this field and to robotics?
I went to the University of Michigan, got an English degree, wanted to be a sports writer. And then decided that I didn't want to put in the time at a weekly newspaper that I was hired for. And I decided I would do something else, and I went to work for the Central Business District Association in downtown Detroit. I loved working there. I loved being a part of an association. I didn't know such a thing existed until this job. And then I went to work for an association that was the Society of Manufacturing Engineers in Dearborn, working on robotics activities. All this time, I was trying to get into a leading PR firm in Detroit, Anthony M. Franco. Finally, after I was at SME for about a month, they offered me a job, and I said no. And the reason I said no is because I realized that SME had a robotics activity. It was really interesting, and they needed people who could communicate these technical developments to the general public. And I felt like I would be pretty good at this. The robotics people broke away from SME. I went with them. We had five people at that point. Today, we have about 20 people. We're extremely well-funded organization working around the world. My job's terrific. I made the right choice.
Fascinating stuff and some perspectives on the future of robotics from Jeff Bernstein with the Association for Advancing Automation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.